Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha.
Welcome to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This May 31st, 2016 edition, episode 92 of Nature Bats Last, comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico. This is Guy McPherson, and I'm going solo from the Mud Hut today. Mike is running from the north rim to the south rim of the Grand Canyon in northern Arizona. If he lives, I'll remind him about my philosophy regarding exercise. No pain, no pain. Our thanks to Afrozen for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. This is a call-in show. Please prepare those questions and get ready to give us a toll-free call at 888-874-4888. I'm joined today by a live studio audience of one. Woo-hoo! My bride of 32 years, 9 months, and 25 days, and also by Dr. Jamie Hecht. You can follow Jamie and his work at his website, jamiehecht.com. Jamie is J-A-M-E-Y. Hecht is H-E-C-H-T, jamiehecht.com. Jamie Hecht is a researcher, a journalist, a singer, a poet, and an artist, a New Yorker through and through. More than 10 years after moving to Los Angeles, his New York City telephone number popped up when I spoke to him on the phone earlier this month. He possesses a PhD in literature. He walked away from a tenure-track position as a professor of literature, a subject he taught for 14 years. He's one of the few people I know who stacks his books too deep on the shelf and is the only person I know who puts his bed in the middle of his bedroom because the walls are covered with bookshelves. Calling him bookish would be an understated compliment. I know this because Jamie hosted me for nearly a week on my speaking tour earlier this month in California. Dr. Hecht has nearly completed his second PhD degree, this one in psychotherapy. He was a senior staff writer at FromTheWilderness.com from 2003 until 2006, and he moved to Southern California to conduct research for Michael C. Rupert in 2005. Among Hecht's 4 books are fascinating titles, including translations of Plato and Sophocles, as well as How to Write About Homer and Limousine Midnight Blue, 50 Frames from the Zapruder Film. How to Write About Homer describes how to write about one of the best-known writers of tragedy in history. Limousine Midnight Blue is about the tragedy of President John F. Kennedy's assassination by the United States Central Intelligence Agency. Thank you for joining us at Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, Dr. Jamie Hecht.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm honored. This is one of my favorite shows, Guy.
That's great to hear. Thank you. You have quite a resume. You've gone from the classroom to the couch, from college professor to psychotherapist. Please share some of the similarities and differences as you move from one venue to the other.
Well, both the teaching vocation and the vocation of the therapist involves empathy and interpretation. And when you teach literature or, I think, any of the humanities, or if done properly, even the sciences, as you'll know so well, empathy is really a part of the job, primarily, of course, because of the real men and women in the seats of the classroom whose intellectual and emotional development you're there to facilitate and to foster, but partly because books, and particularly those of literature, especially poetry, but also fiction and drama, come from the hearts of real men and women, most of whom walked the earth in days past. And in order to understand those texts, we have to really inhabit them and breathe their air. And that's done through this faculty of empathy that is central to being a shrink. And interpretation is also a big part of both jobs. And in both jobs, you help people to cope with their existential anxiety and to wrestle with ultimate questions. They're not too different, really, from the religious vocation, with the exception that, by and large, teaching the humanities and being a psychotherapist don't entail any doctrinal commitments. You know, at no point do you have to espouse a hypothesis about how many children Lady Macbeth had, or whether Freud was right to exclude some particular member of his original inner circle. I mean, you don't have to commit to any matters of faith or dogma. You just get in there and listen with compassion and respect, and then you interpret. And that's what I try to do.
You bring up empathy, and I think empathy is the most important thing we can possibly learn. And I have no idea how to teach it. I worked at it for essentially my entire career in the classroom. And at some point, my students did learn empathy. And it was through some of what I was trying to teach. But it's a very, very difficult thing to infer upon somebody. You can teach somebody how to do the times tables and how to do basic addition and how to memorize and how to understand. But empathy, what's your take on that? How do you get other people to be empathetic toward each other?
I think the best thing that you can do is model it for them. And if they feel your care, it stirs something in them which sort of disposes them to reciprocate. And that doesn't always work, but I think it's the best we've got. It's sort of like the infectious character of laughter or of singing a tune that we all hold in common. It gets picked up by the nervous system of the next person, and sort of becomes the coin of the realm. In a well-functioning society, people reward empathy and discourage violence. And in a culture that's broken and no longer does the jobs that culture is supposed to do, people valorize violence and they cast aspersion and shame on empathy as though it were somehow a virtue of only the weak who had no choice but to be empathic. And although I love Nietzsche for lots of other things, I have little respect for that element of his thought, which we might call contempt for empathy. And indeed, though I deny empathy as any sort of weakness, I think it's the greatest of human strength. Nietzsche also has contempt for weakness, which I think is the weakest pillar of his thought. And if I could add something to the answer to your question, it would be that the neuroscience, the developmental neuroscience, in which I'm not especially well-versed, but I'm acquainted with the rudiments of it, seems to indicate that trauma and deprivation, a too-muchness that we call abuse and a not-enoughness that we call neglect, tends to impoverish people's capacity for empathy. But we also know that in some way which remains poorly understood, there is this thing called resilience, where some of the people who have been through the worst shit come out with their capacities enhanced to feel other people's difficulties, their problems, and their insoluble predicaments. And that warm solidarity makes them feel more alive and benefits the people for whom they have that compassion. I think both accounts are true, that if a whole lot of bad stuff happens to you, it makes it hard to remain sensitive because it's overwhelming, and yet somehow some people come out of trauma with an enhanced capacity to feel other people's pain and to tolerate it. When I say feel other people's pain, I don't necessarily mean there's a one-to-one correspondence between what the empath experiences and what the person experiences who sits across the table from her at the coffee shop, but they're somehow on the same wavelength. And that's a profound mystery that stirs in me deep feelings of respect.
I agree, and yet it seems that some people are well-attuned, are naturally empathic, or maybe it's not natural. I just don't know enough about it. And for other people, it seems virtually impossible for them to experience empathy. Do you know enough about the field, enough about the discipline to know what predisposes some people to being empathic and predisposes others to being, it seems to me, almost clinically incapable of empathy?
Well, I can name drop the people who are hundreds of times better equipped to speak to the issue in concrete terms than I am, especially, for example, the developmental neuroscientist Alan Shore, whose books are read by everybody who's concerned about this issue professionally or in a scholarly way. Peter Fonagy is very deep on this issue, Donnell Stern. But my very basic acquaintance with it is it does have a neural substrate. That is, there is a physical basis for that aspect of our cognitive and affective life, our mental and emotional life, just as there's a physical basis for presumably everything that we think and feel. Being in love is dopamine. It's not reducible to dopamine. One would be, to use a metaphor, one would be essentially deaf to the music if one thought that being in love was only a bunch of billiard ball molecules knocking around in a cerebral pool table. Of course, it's far more than that phenomenon, as music is far more than compression waves in the air. And yet, music has a physical substrate of compression waves in the air, and if that's not there, if the neural wiring is simply missing or chaotic, as it is in people whom we call psychopaths and sociopaths, then they're not going to be able to come up with much, even should they attempt to reach for it. On the other hand, those conditions are pretty rare, and people can be, most of us, acculturated toward empathy when we get taught that it is safe to empathize, that it is admirable to empathize, that we will probably be the recipients of empathy in our turn because it tends to be reciprocal. And it's very difficult to invent that stuff out of whole cloth if you've never been exposed to it. I would imagine that people raised in a hyper-militaristic, hyper-masculine society like ancient Sparta or Nazi Germany, or increasingly the contemporary United States, would be hard put to improvise as if from nowhere empathic feelings, let alone a whole culture of empathy. But like literacy, empathy goes underground and seems to disappear for a time in particular parameters of time and space, and again, like literacy, empathy can reemerge. So as long as there's hope, there's hope. And when there's no hope, there's meaning. And when there's no meaning, there's no mind there to experience the lack of it.
Great. You also mentioned doctrinal commitments. And at least in the teaching I did in the classroom, it seemed that for anything significant to be learned, there had to be a lot of unlearning to occur first. There is this doctrine that we are all raised within, this set of living arrangements that, as you point out, comes with it increasingly a lack of empathy and inability to understand one another. What about with you? What about with your chosen professions? In the classroom and beyond the classroom, how much learning and unlearning are going on, and is there a relationship there?
Oh, that's a great question. I guess one approach is to think about the often arising differences between what you think the point is when you start and what turns out to be the point. People come to higher education out of a very reasonable concern that they're not going to be able to put food on the table unless they have the appropriate degrees. But gradually, it becomes clear that not only does the appropriate degree by no means guarantee the meeting of those economic needs, though it can help. It's also the case that there are needs beyond the economic, which education perhaps alone can aspire to satisfy. And once people get a taste of that, the fact that they can live more meaningful, some people say fully human and by way of the humanities, lives, as a result of study and intellectual collaboration and being part of a learning community, it becomes very difficult to forget that and go back to the idea that what you're there to do is to curry favor with administrators who will or will not grant you a piece of paper with a stamp on it that comes from a university that itself has a stamp called accreditation so that you can get past the gatekeepers and go on to make money. I don't have contempt for that model. It's just that the scope of such an ambition is absolutely tiny compared to the real purpose of education, which is to discover our place in the cosmos, the ordered whole of the universe, and reconcile ourselves to human limits in the brief time that we have together on Earth, what Dante called this so brief vigil of the senses. Comparably, in psychotherapy, often people come in because they want help with a crisis, which, again, perfectly reasonable motivation. And it's one of the best things you can do for yourself is to seek out consultation with a trained, licensed psychotherapist in order to cope with some emergent set of very challenging circumstances which tax your ability to defend against it, given the knowledge of yourself that you have up to that point. However, in partaking of psychotherapy and being listened to with compassion and patience and respect, you discover that, in fact, you can not only save your life by this means, but enhance it and come into greater awareness of who you are and who the people around you are. Sometimes people fear that it's somehow selfish to go and see a therapist. In fact, it's one of the most pro-social rather than anti-social or self-serving things that you can do, because you're a whole lot better equipped to understand, empathize with, and support other people in their suffering, their setbacks, challenges, and mistakes, if you've tried to engage in a journey of coming to grips with your own. It makes you a better friend, better family member, better partner. Hell, I suppose it makes you a better employee, too, because you're able to apply the brakes of thought rather than to rush impulsively into defensive reactions that don't serve you well and that can, in fact, be quite disruptive to the community.
There's quite the parallel there with classroom teaching, with the public education and private educational process as well. As a classroom teacher, one's work is very public. It's also very personal, perhaps even to the point of exposing one's vulnerabilities to those watching you. What about the work after the classroom for you? Is it public? Is it personal in ways similar to the classroom you found yourself in for many years?
It's not so different. Of course, there are rules of confidentiality around psychotherapy, which are rather sacred and have to be kept with a great accustomed vigilance that's part of the vocation. But on the other hand, there is, at least in the relational model of psychotherapy that I tend to practice, a certain scope for clinically appropriate self-disclosure. On the other hand, what I think you're more likely referring to is the way that a practitioner communicates with the outside world. And I've written some postings on other people's websites. Come to think of it, a brief piece about couples therapy on a website called marriage.com. And I have a blog that I maintain called Poetry Politics Collapse. I'll probably start one that's more strictly germane to psychotherapy, but since 2008 I've been writing that blog, Poetry Politics Collapse, and that's one avenue by which I sort of come forward as a person. I'm still very actively publishing scholarship, which is sort of weird because I'm not a professor of literature anymore, but it's part of what I do and part of my role in the world, I feel, if that's not too grandiose, to read and interpret texts from literature, religion, philosophy, and history. I have a paper coming out in a couple of weeks in someone's book called Evil Incarnate, and my paper is about guilt, evil, and the supernatural in Macbeth, Hamlet, and Christopher Marlowe's Dr. Faustus. There's no possible professional payoff for doing something like that. I'm not trying to get tenure. I no longer teach at a university. But it's such an entrenched part of me, and I feel this is part of the way that I bring meaning to my life. I practice the arts, and I practice scholarship. And if somebody notices, and it's of service to her or him, that's great. And if nobody notices, why then I've done what I'm here to do. I've been pious toward my heroes, people like Shakespeare, Marlowe, Robert Kennedy, and President Kennedy, and so on. There's a whole galaxy of people who have lived before me who mean a lot to me, and I know lots of people who organize their passions in that sort of way. Just had a paper come out on sovereignty and denial in Paradise Lost of John Milton and Dr. Faustus of Christopher Marlowe. And the last one I'll mention is that about a month from now is a wonderful old that is long-standing psychoanalytic journal called American Imago, in which I have a paper coming out about Ingmar Bergman's fantastic 1957 film Wild Strawberries called Ingmar Bergman's Wild Strawberries, The Failure of Sublimation and the Fate of Pain. So I'm coming out swinging in various fields. To practice the writer's vocation.
All of these examples point out that you're a liberal in the historical sense, in that you contain multitudes. How, in this world of compartmentation, did you manage to write poetry, nonfiction, and essays, pursue singing and psychotherapy, alongside life as a researcher and a college professor, a life that still continues as a college professor with respect to your service and your ability to connect, synthesize, organize, integrate information, and put it out there for the public, into the public realm? How did you manage that in a world that increasingly is characterized by silos with very steep walls?
Oh, thanks a hell of a lot. That's a really great thing to say to somebody. That Walt Whitman quotation, "I am large, I contain multitudes." Do I contradict myself? Very well, then I contradict myself. I feel like you and I are sort of players on the same team in that regard, because you know, so many books about ecology and the various sub-disciplines which it comprises, and also these books of striking courage sounding the alarm bell about the fate of the human community and of the living planet. That's as eclectic as anything I've done. And when I read your book, Walking Away from Empire, I really felt I recognized a kindred spirit, because like you, if I'm correct, I never identified with the culture of specialization and always sort of bumped against the edges of it, like that childhood game Operation, where a buzzer goes off when the alligator clip touches the electrified wall of the particular compartment that it happens to be in. I just always thought it was kind of bizarre. And some of the authors I love the best have been the people whose work transcended disciplinary boundaries. There's one that comes to mind, a great Austrian philosopher, Ludwig Wittgenstein, said, the way chemistry is taught is that hydrogen plus oxygen equals water. Anyone who doesn't understand is stupid. Whereas, of course, what he meant was that in reality, the beginning of knowledge of chemistry, in this case physical chemistry, comes at the point where one has already digested the obvious part about combining those two atoms and getting that compound. All the passion lies in trying to come to grips with the mysterious phenomenon of the wetness of water and its transparency, its liquidity, all those emergent properties which come about when you combine two gases whose phenomenal properties are utterly distinct from that. So the reality is hydrogen plus oxygen equals water. Anyone who claims to understand, having merely said that, is in fact missing the boat. Whereas the beginning of wisdom is the ancient Greek wonderment that such a combination could produce a product so radically different from its constituents. And you got to be an interdisciplinary person with one foot in philosophy and another in chemistry or physics in order to appreciate that fact, I believe.
That's great. That's a wonderful answer. Thank you. You reminded me that just yesterday I was working on my own photovoltaic solar system, reconnecting the batteries, and I had the equivalent of the alligator clip, except this time it was real, and it shocked the shit out of me. And it reminded me that maybe I was a little better at my life in the classroom than I am out here doing these pragmatic things. But not to worry. All the burn marks are gone now, and I'm pretty much fully recovered. In addition to being a liberal in the historical sense, you're also a radical in the historical sense. You get to the root of myriad issues with a combination of reason, logic, and the compilation of evidence. How did you develop those tools? Was it something in your educational background, or did it just come to you out of the blue? I mean, where does that come from?
I don't know. I know I had an experience in graduate school at Brandeis in 1989 when I was 21 years old and I first arrived there. And I was studying with the late Alan Grossman, who was a genius in his own right and, in fact, was recognized as such by the MacArthur Foundation that gave him a sizable genius grant toward the end of his career. And I was taking a seminar in the poetry of Walt Whitman that he was teaching, and a paper was assigned, and I sat down at the typewriter and felt nothing was moving through my mind. And I was kind of panicked and despairing, but I had a friend there who had been studying in the program for a few years already. And she said, don't worry, it'll come, stay at the keyboard. So I did, and went through a few more rounds of this despair and reassurance. And eventually something softened up, and a different part of my mind opened up to the poem, and which was the Song of Myself from Leaves of Grass. And after a short while, the part of me that responds to other people who are my contemporaries, whom I know, sort of got recruited into the service of the effort to interpret the poem. And it became clear to me, you know, Whitman says at one point in Leaves of Grass, who touches this book touches a man. All of these poems and novels and dramas come from real people and their struggles. So if you know how to be a friend to somebody and to listen to what she's saying, you know how to interpret a poem. The rest is sort of mechanics that are the lay of the land to which you acclimate yourself through practice and study and listening to people who have honed those skills already. And I guess that's what comes to mind when you ask that. I don't know how I learned to interpret stuff.
That's great.
The best I got.
You're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Guy McPherson, and I'm joined today by researcher, journalist, singer, poet, artist, and kindred spirit, Jamie Hecht. Jamie, you edited Michael C. Rupert's magnum opus, Crossing the Rubicon, The Decline of the American Empire at the Age of Oil. Although we never met in person, Mike was a friend of mine who was influential in getting my message heard, primarily through his radio show. You worked alongside Rupert for a few years, and you probably knew him as well as anybody during that time. I'm sure you have many thoughts and feelings about working with him. Can you share some of them with us?
Yeah, I can. There's a very detailed account of who Mike was written by a mutual friend, Jenna Orkin, whose career as an activist includes some great public service in her organization that deals with the health of people in the vicinity of the World Trade Center during and after 9/11, including first responders, school children at Stuyvesant High School, and Manhattan residents in general. But that's just one of the many terrific things Jenna Orkin has done. And she wrote this book called Scout that was a memoir of who Mike was. They were pretty close. But as for me, I knew him. I loved him. He was a difficult person. He had a pretty severe trauma background. He was in many ways a very narcissistic man. He did not suffer fools easily. He was very thin-skinned. He was arrogant. He was brilliant. He was exceedingly strong-willed. He was resilient and tenacious and the bearer of an extraordinary degree of courage. Anybody who Googles Mike will find him or herself watching a brief YouTube video from 1995 of a public town hall meeting at Locke High School in South Central Los Angeles, in which the then director of the Central Intelligence Agency, John Deutsch, sat at a dais with some of his colleagues, attempting to assuage the livid anger of the local black community at the CIA, because people on the ground in the neighborhood knew full well that the agency was involved in the crack cocaine epidemic that decimated the black community and other communities at that time. And the CIA engaged in its usual culture of plausible deniability, and it had the temerity to stage this event of a public town hall meeting where they simply deny it. Mike came to the microphone, one of the only white people in the audience, looking for all the world like the stereotype of the cop, rather portly gentleman, white as a sheet, big cop mustache, big old glasses on his face, and leaned into the microphone and said, for all the world to hear, "I am a former LAPD officer. I worked in narcotics, and I can tell you the CIA has been dealing crack cocaine in South Central Los Angeles for a long time." At that point, the room exploded with cheers, indignant relief, a kind of bitter joy at being taken seriously and having one's knowledge validated by somebody who is both an outsider to the community and very much an insider to the police side of it. And Congresswoman Maxine Waters banged the gavel and restored order, and Mike continued into the microphone, on camera, live on C-SPAN, saying the CIA attempted to recruit me to Operations Pegasus, Amadeus, and Watchtower. And on he went. At that point in the video, you see then-Director of Central Intelligence, or DCI, John Deutsch, make a clearly symbolic hand gesture, you know, nothing anybody would do accidentally or casually, which signals, "We have to end this meeting. Things have gotten out of hand." And the meeting ended, and that was it. Now, by that point, Mike had been made homeless. He had been shot at. And after the C-SPAN appearance, his life was in even greater jeopardy, as it would come to be on several occasions over the next few years. He ran a newsletter online and on paper called From the Wilderness, which comes from that biblical verse, Vox clamantis in deserto, a voice crying out in the wilderness. It's a metaphor for a whistleblower. And through the late 90s, he kept publishing it, and then 9/11 happened. And he immediately said, oh, shit, what is this? Who is responsible for this? I was living in Brooklyn at the time. I'd never heard of Mike. And the first plane hit, and I thought, where is the Air Force? This is the most powerful Air Force in the world. And it can't defend the financial capital of the country? And then the second plane hit, and it was just obvious that something had neutralized the people whose passionate commitment is to do their jobs and stop exactly that kind of attack. I'm referring, of course, to the military fighter pilots who didn't respond. It then became evident a little later that morning that the military's own building, the Pentagon, which, as John Judge made clear, has had missile batteries on its roof since the early 50s, couldn't defend itself either, even with a budget of over $1 trillion. This struck me as utterly implausible, and I looked around to see who was doing the best work on the subject of 9/11. I came across Mike's work, found that he was speaking at a few months later, that he was speaking at Riverside Church in Harlem, and at that time I had moved from Brooklyn to Harlem to take some courses at Columbia University. And Riverside Church, of course, is where the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who was also executed by the United States government, I say also, not meaning in addition to Mike, who took his own life, but in addition to so many other heroes of the truth, where this was the church where Dr. King had given his most famous speech, Why I Oppose the War in Vietnam. So it was very fitting that Mike would be speaking there. I went, heard him, did a great job. I gave him a business card and asked him to give me a try. He said, I never do this, but I have a good feeling about you. Write an article for me as a trial, as a tryout, and call it The Limited Hangouts of 9/11. So that was the first piece that I wrote for him. He liked it. I became a regular contributor to From the Wilderness, and eventually he made me senior staff writer and then assistant managing editor. And I edited his book in 2004 in time for the election, Crossing the Rubicon, which is a case of means, motive, and opportunity against then Vice President Dick Cheney for the crimes of 9/11. Now, why would I talk about that on the radio? Because I'm just a language guy. I wasn't doing investigative reporting, really. I did almost no investigative reporting. That was Mike's job. But I helped to set the language in order, and I wrote up summaries of news articles that Mike and my colleagues at From the Wilderness and myself would cull from the mainstream media. And we would append commentaries to those as introductions. And sometimes I'd write original essays, which represented analysis and sort of putting together a number of news sources. And that's what I did for him for about 3 years. I came to L.A. In 2005 to work for Mike on site rather than long distance. He moved the company to Oregon, where it met with the hands of fate. I didn't follow to Oregon for personal reasons. My then wife didn't want to move. And the company more or less evaporated until a few years later it took on a new form called CollapseNet. And that survived for a while until eventually Mike could no longer bear the pain of this world and the sight of the living planet being gradually murdered. And he seemed to have come to a view of the cosmos in which the soul is immortal. And he said in one of the interview videos that he did before he died, death is a door, you go through it. And in that regard, he was not really aspiring to his own complete destruction, but was interested in changing form from an embodied human being on the earth to something else. I am in no position to judge whether he was correct or not. I have no idea whether the soul is immortal. I don't see how it could be, but there's plenty that I don't see. I miss him. I wish he hadn't taken his life. And I will add that I come from a family of writers, and my sister is a very brilliant Dr. Jennifer Michael Hecht. And among the books that she's written is her most recent one, which is from Yale University Press, and it's called Stay, A History of Suicide and the Arguments Against It. And she argues in that book that we should not take our own lives because it deprives our past selves of their fulfillment, our future selves of their existence, and it deprives the community of all that we bring to it and to its stability. Suicide is a contagious thing. It can spread in what are called suicide clusters. And so a suicide is also an unwitting homicide. It's best to stay and ride it out and find what meaning you can. Live as fully as you can through creativity and love, and cope with circumstances as best you may. This is what I've learned.
Michael committed suicide a little more than 2 years ago. And the next day, it occurred to me that he had pulled the trigger, but he didn't load the gun. Do you have any thoughts you'd like to share about the earthly end of his heroic, tragic life?
You're speaking metaphorically, I imagine.
Yes, saying that, yes, I am.
There was an author, his name I don't remember, who wrote an essay about Vincent van Gogh, the man suicided by society. Mm-hmm. And I guess I see Mike in those terms. He was loved with a great feeling and great sincerity by the people who identified with him and benefited from his work. As he was dismissed by the vast majority of people, and I think it's perhaps fair to say reviled by the tiny minority of people whose transgressions he had the courage to report. So it's sort of a bell curve. And most of what he met with was, I think, contempt and indifference. There's a vocabulary that people use. It's as old as the hills to dismiss those of us who bring a message that the hearers do not want to hear, let alone listen to. And you're at least as familiar with it as I am. And it includes words like the verb peddle, the verb hawk. If you write a book in an effort to communicate with the population, you are hawking or peddling your message, whereas the people who are saying things of which the mainstream approves are simply propounding or articulating or, at worst, selling books. Why not sell a book? Only the dissident is said to hawk or to peddle his message. There's the phrase conspiracy theory, which, as you know, is an invention of the Central Intelligence Agency from, I believe, 1967 in a memo whose purpose was and subject was discrediting critics of the Warren Commission. After all, it's kind of bizarre that would be the phrase. A conspiracy theory about what? Well, a theory of the case of the murder of President Kennedy. It's a legal theory. It is a theory that people conspired, and in fact, we now know, I don't say believe, we now know that people conspired to murder the 35th president, that they conspired to pull off various other crimes of state. And we know quite a bit about who in particular did what to whom and when and why and by what means. The best book about that case is James Douglas, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters. In addition to James Douglas's great book, JFK and the Unspeakable, Why He Died and Why It Matters, there's a very different book, which is in just about complete agreement with it, from a few years earlier by Peter Dale Scott, called Deep Politics and the Death of JFK. Conspiracy theory is a thought-stopping, Orwellian newspeak term. It means thus far and no further. It's time to turn your mind off and go back the way you came. Nothing to see here, folks. So it is with nut, a tinfoil hat, Yahoo. I mean, the list goes on and on. And, of course, there are people who, in my judgment or yours, in fact, merit that kind of contemptuous language. Among them, I would number, for example, Holocaust deniers, or, in a very different and less malicious spirit, people who deny that the Apollo 11 spacecraft successfully landed astronauts on the moon and returned them safely to Earth. Some of these people I regard as naive. Others I regard as perverse. Why mention them? Because it's a very frequently used tactic of disinformationists to propound claims which are controversial and, in fact, true, which is to say the preponderance of the evidence supports them beyond a reasonable doubt, but to mix in with that truth-telling toxic hypotheses like Holocaust denial, absurd hypotheses like the hypothesis that the moon launch was faked, in order to discredit everything else which is bundled up with them. This counterintelligence programs do all the time. If you want to discredit what somebody is saying that's controversial, you say the same thing that he or she is saying, and you say something which is either absurd or repugnant or both. Mike was the victim of every trick in the book, and he just kept on fighting. He kept on clarifying every slander that was sent in his direction, stood up for himself every time, challenged people to debate. He used to point out that his book, Crossing the Rubicon, had never been the object of a libel suit, whereas you would expect that if he had falsely accused the Vice President of the United States and CEO of Halliburton Incorporated of neutralizing the Air Force by scheduling, I don't remember the number, but it's more than six simultaneous war game drills right during the week of September the 9th, when upwards of eight foreign and domestic intelligence agencies had warned the United States that civilian aircraft would be used as weapons blown into buildings symbolic of American life, and had thereby neutralized the Air Force, not with a stand-down order, but by dispersing all the relevant fighter aircraft away from the Northeast Air Defense Sector, and conversely, by polluting the screens of the air traffic controllers at the FAA and at NORAD with virtual blips, which were part of the war game drills, and not part of what was actually going on in the sky, that if all that were untrue, and Mike alleged it in the pages of his book, he would have been sued for libel. No one ever sued him for libel. Presumably, that was because a court case that came to grips with the evidence for this stuff would have proven the unthinkable and verified Mike's hypothesis. I have no trouble speaking of this stuff on the air because it's been out since 2004. The way that the establishment deals with it is by ignoring it. Only if one is expanding the hole in their illusion do they mobilize. I'm simply pointing at the hole that's already there and saying, yep, I guess nobody cares. And by nobody, I mean nobody larger than the community of activists who are already concerned. There's an article, very recent article, about the Trump phenomenon by Adam Gopnik, who's a very smart cultural critic, lives in Paris. He's an American. And in the course of making his point, which has to do with Trump and how Trump's arguments have very little to do with economics, he sort of tosses off this sentence about how there are nuts on both sides of the political spectrum, but the 9/11 truth nuts had no influence on politics, whereas the birthers were central to Republican politics. Why bother to take a swipe at the 9/11 truth movement? Well, it's part of the way you show your legitimacy, is that you are not one of ces gens-là, those people over there, the unwashed, the marginalized critics. you can be trusted because you are singing the majoritarian hymns that marshal to the banner of people like Hillary Clinton, that represent extreme rightism as though it were centrism. You can be trusted because you are playing the majoritarian game. And if that's what those people need to do, I certainly can't stop them. All I can do is occasionally put pen to paper and point out that that, in my judgment, is what is happening. And Mike did that with far greater courage than I'll ever have. And he did it until he couldn't do it anymore.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. On a related note, the American citizenry seemingly displays collective amnesia during every election cycle. The same narrative applies every time. If we can just get our person in power, things will be different. What are your thoughts on the power of the U.S. presidency since, say, November 1963?
Well, I know I don't fully understand it, but I also know I have some thoughts about it that have stuck with me pretty tenaciously. I think the beauty of the CIA's position is that it appears to do whatever the president wants it to do while simultaneously creating an atmosphere in which the president can only ask it to do what the CIA in fact wants to do anyway. It's not the case that the CIA is the prime mover in current political reality. The Defense Intelligence Agency, as John Judge used to point out, is many, many times larger, both in personnel and in budget, than is the Central Intelligence Agency. And yet, the CIA has played an historically decisive role. It's not the only entity within the U.S. government and associated institutions, largely corporate institutions, that has had a decisive effect on things. But as so many of us have noticed, when you look at the history of U.S. foreign policy as it is in fact practiced, the de facto foreign policy, you find regime after regime overthrown throughout the world when leaders of the citizens' movements in those countries achieved political power and attempted to nationalize industries, chiefly petroleum and other natural resources, for the benefit of their domestic population. Arbenz in Guatemala, Mossadegh in Iran, Allende in Chile, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. I'm not saying these people are all saints, but they did act as if they had the interests of their people in mind. Patrice Lumumba in the Congo and President John F. Kennedy in the United States. These people were crushed because the moneyed interests with whom the CIA has to do, let it be known in one way or another, to which I'm not privy, that they wanted those murders to take place. And so they did. So in a way, you know, Bill Hicks the great political comedian had a joke where he said every time anybody gets elected to the presidency, a small group of men take him into him or her into a dark back room where they show a copy of the Zapruder film shot from an angle that nobody has ever seen before. And then the lights come back on and they say to the president-elect, any questions?
And his response is, just what's my agenda?
Yeah. So on the one hand, I think the presidency is not nearly so powerful as it was before the military coup of November 22nd, 1963. That removed President Kennedy from power at the hands of his hardliners. And on the other hand, I think there is such a thing as a powerful president, because if there weren't, the coup would never have taken place. Noam Chomsky, who is on the one hand a dissident who speaks volumes of important truths about U.S. foreign policy, and on the other hand, is a professional liar about the Kennedy administration and its role and its record, and certainly about the assassination of the president. Chomsky seems to believe that all decisive historical events are the product of faceless structural forces, and that individual conscience and courage and choice mean little or nothing on the stage of history, whereas that simply cannot be right. There's a dialectic between faceless structural forces, social movements and hierarchies of power, and the people who actually populate that human landscape. And you can tell that that's true because people like the brothers Greki in the ancient world got killed. They were aristocrats like President Kennedy, who, like President Kennedy, and indeed like Julius Caesar, reached around the aristocracy and joined forces with the general population. This is a sin which the ruling class cannot forgive. What comes up for me is the question about Bernie Sanders' candidacy is whether or not he can exceed our expectations and perform some of what he, I believe, passionately espouses. I take him to be entirely sincere, by making compromises. So that what killed Robert F. Kennedy was that he fought the trio of militarism, poverty, and racism all at the same time. Bernie Sanders is not nearly so anti-war as Robert F. Kennedy was. He is anti-racism and he is anti-poverty. He is pro-peace, but that's something different from actually stopping wars. And I, for one, do not begrudge him his opportunity to survive and get his work done. I would prefer if he were a morally pure candidate who was going to ride into the teeth of the dragon swinging his lance until he was crushed, I suppose. But it may be that I and everybody else would benefit a lot more from somebody making a prudent compromise and trying to reform the system from within. Is it likely? By no means. I have to believe, however, that it is possible, and I see him surviving primary after primary. I pray for his safety insofar as I get myself to pray at all in this mysterious cosmos governed by who knows what. And I think if he is going to succeed, it's going to be by making some kind of compromise, and that militarism can be stopped by mass social movements, if by anything, rather than by a chief executive, because those days, I fear, have come and gone.
I agree. This has been a wonderful conversation, and we're out of time. The studio has bumped me a couple of times to remind me of that. Thank you for joining me today, Jamie Hecht.
Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Again, you can follow Dr. Hecht's work at jamiehecht.com. That spelling is JameyHecht. And that's a wrap for today's show. We'll catch you next week on the radio. As we all know, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, nature bats last.
Mother Nature, she's gonna get you.